Good morning, everyone. Hope you had a nice weekend. So I'm a bit jet lagged today, and so please excuse me if my brain is a little fuzzy. But I understand David lectured you on various topics last week, including equivalence principle, Newton's bucket, things like that. But he didn't actually introduce the metric. Is that right? Okay, good. So that's where I'll start. And please interrupt if there's anything I'm assuming which he didn't cover. Okay, so let's recall that in Minkowski space-time, the Lorentz invariant distance is given by minus c squared dt squared plus dx squared. Okay, so if you have two nearby points in Minkowski spacetime, and you want to know the squared distance between them, this is the distance you should use. This distance is one which every observer related by a Lorentz transformation will agree on. Okay, so remember that this is written as eta mu nu dx mu dx nu. And it's invariant under x mu goes to x mu prime, which is lambda mu nu x nu. Okay, so there are a set of linear transformations of the coordinates which leave this distance invariant. And these linear transformations are called Lorentz transformations. And they satisfy lambda mu nu lambda alpha beta eta mu alpha equals eta mu beta. How many independent Lorentz transformations are there? Six, right? This equation allows six independent parameters. Okay, there are three boosts and three rotations. And so the Lorentz group is a six-parameter group specified by this equation. So I think David will have talked last week about curved spacetime. Did he discuss that at all? He did in general terms, okay, with the connection. Okay. So Einstein's idea was sort of completely remarkable, which is that having unified space and time into spacetime, Einstein and Minkowski, and found that that all the laws of physics have to be written in this form. All the laws of physics are written in tensor form, plus spinors, which are a generalization, in tensor form, and they are invariant under Lorentz transformations. Okay, so Lorentz transformations are only linear transformations. It's very natural to think of nonlinear transformations. Could x be a more complicated, could x prime be a more complicated function of x? Could it be some kind of power series in x? That was one thought. In particular, Why restrict to frames which move at constant speed relative to each other? Okay, because constant speed relative to each other is related to the linearity of the transformation. You just have t prime being some linear function of t, x prime being some linear function of x and t. And so the velocity in the second frame is linear if one frame is moving relative to another, then its coordinates are just changing by some constant velocity. So in particular, let's think about an accelerating coordinate system, right? If I decide that I'm going to be accelerated, that let's say if x prime is x plus a half at squared, then if the person in let's consider some particle obeying this equation. So the particle has coordinates in this x system, and imagine the particle is just moving along steadily. Well, obviously, in the x prime coordinate system, d2x, so if, then d2x prime dt squared is going to look like 0 from here and a from there. And so you may say that then, so in the x prime coordinate system, it'll look like the particle is experiencing a force given by ma equals. Okay, so in the x coordinate system, there was no force, but just because the x prime coordinate system is accelerating away, it looks like the same particle sees a force of ma. So it was natural to start thinking of these nonlinear coordinate transformations and to think about the kinds of forces that could appear as a result of them. And then the obvious, well, with hindsight, obvious idea which Einstein had is that maybe that's what gravity is. Okay, that we know that in gravity, so Einstein said, well, maybe that's what the gravitational force is. Because the special thing about the gravitational force is that it's always proportional to the mass of the object, and the force per unit mass is the same for everything. And so rather than gravity acting on the body because of its properties, its mass, one could say, well, instead, maybe gravity is some kind of fictitious acceleration, so that all objects fall in exactly the same way, just because, in a sense, there isn't really a force at all. So this was Einstein's basic insight, is that maybe the gravitational force is not so much a force as a property of spacetime. And since all objects move in the same spacetime, maybe this accounts for the force. And that turned out to be true. And in fact, it's an amazing thing that the way the universe works is that you take all the laws of physics, electromagnetism, the weak force, the strong force, and we're allowed to understand all those in a little laboratory, okay? And in that laboratory, we can choose the laboratory such that gravity is completely irrelevant. Okay, and that's in fact the equivalence principle, which we'll come to in a moment. The equivalence principle says that the laws of physics in the presence of gravity are exactly what they were in the absence of gravity, according to someone who only explores a little region of space-time. Okay, so in other words, physicists doing local experiments can forget about gravity.
Not a force like other forces, why are people looking for gauge bosons for it?
Yeah, it's a good question. Why are people looking for gauge bosons? I wouldn't say. You see, gauge bosons themselves are a little bit fictitious too.
And we treat other forces, but we treat
Right.
other forces with gauge bosons. So
There's
why
a
is it? Why are we looking for the gravity to act the same way if it's not a vector force?
It is a force, but it's not a local force. Okay. So now you have to take all these things with a grain of salt because I can construct a graviton, and the graviton will hit a particle and deflect it. Okay. You see, in that experiment, you would definitely be looking sort of on a large scale because the graviton would have a short wavelength and it would come in and it would deflect the particle, and I would be looking on a bigger scale. The statement of the equivalence principle is if you look with a tiny microscope, much smaller than the length scale of the graviton, then actually you could explain everything without gravity being there at all. We'll see this. It's good you're asking, but you're jumping ahead a little bit. So that's what we're going to start to do. We're going to consider coordinate transformations which are more general than linear. And we're going to be looking for some kind of force which, or effective force which emerges, which isn't a local force, really. It's somehow a force which is only apparent when you look in big enough regions of space-time. And this is the way the universe is designed, that we can understand the forces on small scales, ignoring gravity. And then somehow the way in which we include gravity is determined, is almost completely determined by whatever we found on small scales. Okay, so we'll see this emerging. So for curved space-time, so we call Minkowski space-time flat space-time. And the picture is just like a flat sheet of paper or Euclidean space that we think of geometry in. And general relativity is formulated in terms of curved space-time. And basically, curved space-time is defined to be some kind of space, which locally looks like flat space-time. Okay, that's the definition of curved space-time. And so locally, within some small region, it looks as if you're in flat space-time, and all the laws of physics are just the flat space-time laws. And then the trick in recovering gravity is just to kind of glue all these locally flat space-times together into a curved space-time, and then gravity emerges naturally from that, from the curvature of space-time. So in curved space-time, the distances are measured using a metric. And the metric is just the analog of the eta mu nu. This is called the Minkowski metric, right? Remember, this is minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1, with zeros everywhere else. This is the Minkowski metric. In curved space-time, you can have a completely general metric, g mu nu, which is any function of x, dx mu, dx nu, where g mu nu of x is an arbitrary 4 by 4 symmetric matrix. And that has 10 independent components. Okay, and each one of those components is a completely arbitrary function of x, apart from the following conditions. The conditions are that one, g mu nu, should be invertible. And that means that the determinant should not be zero. And two, that it should have three positive and one negative eigenvalues. Okay, just like eta has three positive eigenvalues in the space directions and the one negative eigenvalue in the time direction. We require the same thing of this G mu nu. And a metric like this is called pseudo-Riemannian. Okay, Riemann invented the subject of the geometry of curved surfaces. And Riemann was thinking about curved surfaces which were locally flat Euclidean space. Euclidean space has a metric plus one everywhere. Pseudo means that one of the eigenvalues is minus one. That's very important for physics because that's the time. And that's why time is different than space. But okay, so we say that a space possessing such a metric is locally Minkowski. Okay, and the reason we can say that is that because I can always choose coordinates. The metric was written in that form, in the coordinates x. But I can always choose coordinates so that the metric at a point is actually equal to the Minkowski metric. We can always choose coordinates so that the metric at one point is equal to the Minkowski metric. Okay, so to see that, notice that because G mu nu is a, let's call it XP, this is one particular point. Okay, so any symmetric matrix can, of course, be diagonalized. So I can write O alpha mu, O beta nu, and basically, so there because G is symmetric, so there exists matrix O such that this is diagonal, d alpha beta, diagonal. Okay, this equation is just that O G O transpose equals the diagonal matrix. Okay, so if you ever have a symmetric matrix, you can diagonalize it with such a transformation. And of course, this means that G equals O transpose G O. This is an orthogonal matrix. So O transpose O is 1. Sorry, that should be a D. And furthermore, we can choose the diagonal matrix because of this assumption about the eigenvalues has to be of this form, L1 squared, L2 squared, L3 squared. Okay, so with one negative and three positive eigenvalues. So if we defining L as equal to, matrix L as equal to L0, L1, L2, L3, we have that G is equal to OL eta L transpose O transpose. Or dx mu dx mu g mu nu equals dy mu dy nu eta mu nu, where y nu coordinates are equal to the nu coordinates are given by O. L x. Okay, so I'm just replacing here that this dx transpose g dx is equal to dx transpose. Have I got my transposes wrong? Let's see. I should have a few transposes here. Like that. O transpose L eta L O dx, and this is equal to dy transpose eta dy. Okay, so through this transformation, should actually be this way around, LO. Y equal to LOX. We've changed the metric from being this arbitrary symmetric 4x4 matrix to being just eta. Okay. How many parameters did we need to use to do that? How many parameters are there? Let me just summarize. So we can transform G mu nu into eta mu nu using orthogonal matrices, using O and L. The orthogonal matrix has six parameters. Okay, just as we discussed, the boost and rotations. And the L has four parameters. Okay, these four different eigenvalues. Okay, and this accounts for the 10 numbers that there were in G. So the summary of that is that at every spacetime point, it is possible to choose a free fall or locally inertial coordinate system such that, you see, we've only used linear transformations of the coordinates to do this, so that within a sufficiently small what I'm going to say is a generalization of what I said. In fact, okay, so what I've shown you is that at one point, I can redefine my coordinates so that the metric is actually eta at that point. Okay, let me just sort of write that again. So I had some metric. I'm going to, this is by definition equal to a metric in some new, this is a function of x. Okay, so just as in special relativity, when we did coordinate transformations, the quantity with eta here was invariant, right? When I changed x to x prime, it was invariant. In a general coordinate system, the definition of the metric in the new coordinate is it's whatever you get when you replace x with x prime and use this formula, insist on the invariance of the distance. And this leads you to the formula that g mu nu prime of x prime is equal to dx, dx prime mu, dx, dx prime nu, alpha beta, g alpha beta of x. Okay, because all I do here is take differences in the right directions and read off the relationship. These dx's are arbitrary. So if this is true for any dx, you can infer this relationship between g prime and g. And what I've shown you here is that by picking the right linear transformation between x and x prime, that actually I can pick this to be eta mu nu at one point. The generalization of this is that at every spacetime point, it's possible to choose coordinates so that within a sufficiently small neighborhood, g mu nu equals eta mu nu, and the first derivatives of the metric d by dx alpha g mu nu equals 0. Let me put approximately. So what you can do is that at any given point, you can set the metric to eta, and you can set its first derivative to 0. And that basically means that the metric is going to change only by of order x squared as I deviate from that point. And that's really what you mean by small and being close to Minkowski. Okay, and then the laws of physics, take the same form as they do, the same special relativistic form as they do in flat space-time. Okay, so we're going to prove that in a moment, that it's possible to choose the laws in that way. In fact, maybe I'll just do it now. But that's the basic idea, is that in a small region of space-time, you can choose coordinates such that gravity isn't there. It's very, very convenient. So you can figure out all the laws of physics locally, as we do on Earth, and then when we try to expand them to the solar system, or actually even to motion around the Earth, we find we have to include gravity. So let's do this, the proof of this. We have this formula that g mu nu prime of x prime is dx alpha dx prime dx beta dx prime nu g alpha beta of x. Okay, that's the transformation law of the metric. And you can see that the usual statement of special relativistic invariance is just the fact that g is eta, and if I do these Lorentz transformations, where x prime is linear in x, or x is linear in x prime, then the metric remains eta. Okay. In general relativity, the metric doesn't remain eta. You do these transformations, and you get some new metric, some new expressions into some new expression for the metric. And using that freedom, you can, as I said, you can fix the metric to be Minkowski at one point, and furthermore, you can fix its first derivative to be zero. And then you will find the metric only deviates from Minkowski at second order in the displacements from that point. And that deviation from flat space at second order is what encodes the Riemann tensor and the curvature of space, of space-time. Let me just emphasize that we use x prime mu. So a coordinate transformation means we have some set of coordinates. We go to some new set of coordinates, which are functions of the old coordinates. Okay, sometimes when I write this as a function, I'll leave the alpha index in there. Just bear in mind that's not an external index. That just indicates that this is a function of the old coordinates. Sometimes I won't put that in, okay, that x prime is a function of x. But you should think of four quantities, time and three space coordinates, as being functions of the other four quantities. And a very basic fact about such a transformation from one set of coordinates to another set of coordinates is that this transformation is locally 1-to-1. In other words, each point goes to one other point, okay, which is what you want for a coordinate transformation. You don't want it to be double-valued, so that two points go to the same point in the new coordinate system. That would be a singular coordinate transformation. You'd like your coordinate transformation to be 1-to-1, so that each point went to only one other point. It's locally one-to-one if this matrix of first derivatives, dx alpha dx prime mu, is invertible. Okay, so this is a 4x4 matrix. And if it's invertible, then the inverse is just the other guy. So dx prime mu dx alpha dx beta dx prime mu is equal to delta, that's a prime here. This is delta alpha beta, right? Just by the chain rule, because x is a function of x prime. So when I differentiate with respect to x prime, and then I differentiate with x prime with respect to x, this is equal to dx beta by dx alpha, which is delta beta alpha. So these two matrices, the matrices of, well, they're called a Jacobian matrix. Okay, this is the Jacobian. If they are invertible, then the mapping is one-to-one. So we're always going to assume that. But these are good, both good coordinate system in which every point just has one image in the coordinate system. Okay, so now let's do this coordinate transformation. Well, what am I going to assume about x? You see here, what comes into this expression is not x prime as a function of x, but x as a function of x prime. Okay, so let me write down x as a function of x prime. And so let's assume the coordinate transformation has a Taylor series, series about the point, let's call it A alpha. And so we've got x of a alpha prime. Okay, so x is a function of x prime, and if I took the point A prime, okay, that's the coordinate, the point A in the X prime coordinate system, this would be A in the unprime system. Okay, so so then I can expand this X of X prime. X prime around that point, and what I'll get is A mu plus dx mu dx prime mu evaluated at this point times x nu prime minus A nu prime plus d2x dx prime. Let's try and get the indices right. X prime minus A prime, X prime minus A prime, alpha, beta, alpha, beta. Okay, so I have some point whose coordinates are A in the X system, A prime in the X prime system. I now expand my function in a Taylor series around that point. And so when X prime equals to A prime, then X is A. And more generally, I have this series for X as a function of X prime. So in general, these coefficients, these Taylor series coefficients, they're just numbers, and they're completely arbitrary numbers. Okay, so subject to this condition of invertibility, 1-to-1, right? I want this matrix to be invertible in order for the mapping to be 1-to-1, the one coordinate system to the other. And so now we can just plug this expression into here, and we'll get G prime mu nu. And I'm not going to put any indices because there are too many of them. And you'll see the consequence. It's kind of clearer if you don't write the indices down. Okay, so G prime of X prime. What I do is just just substitute this formula into there and calculate the derivatives. And so what I'm going to get is dx prime at A squared. So obviously dx prime, I'm going to get this coefficient, differentiating this guy in here. So I'm going to get this times g. In fact, it's the whole thing evaluated at A. Write it this way, dx prime squared times g evaluated at A. That's the first term. And this is the term I used to fix g prime at A to be eta. Okay, so I can pick all of this to be eta. I've just shown that. There are enough. We can use these dx prime matrix to rotate and then rescale the eigenvalues of g so that g becomes eta. What's in the next term? I take these derivatives, but here I've got some terms in x prime minus a prime squared. So when I take the derivative, one derivative, I'm going to be left with x prime minus a prime. So the next term is going to involve this. dx prime, I'm going to get this matrix, d2x dx prime times g. And then you see the argument of the metric is x. I better use this expression for x, because x is really a function of x prime. And I'm Taylor seriesing around x prime equals a prime. So I have to change I have to substitute this into there as well. Okay, and then expand, and I'm going to get dx prime, and then d prime of g, a derivative of g, right? One derivative of g, d by dx of g. And all of this is going to be multiplied by x prime minus a prime. Plus dot, dot, dot. Okay, so we've worked out the metric in the new coordinate system as a function of the new coordinates. That's really what we want. The first term we've been able to set equal to eta. And now we want to ask, what do I do with this term? See, this term is really encodes the first derivative of the new metric with respect to the coordinates, right? Because it's a linear term in x prime minus a prime. So if I differentiate this guy with respect to x prime and set x prime equals a prime, this term is what's going to survive. Now the question is, can I use these matrices? These are all evaluated at A, okay? Can I use these matrices, the matrices of first and second derivatives, to set this equal to zero? Okay, and the answer is you can. Okay, so first of all, we've already done this. So choose dx dx prime at A to set g equals eta. G prime of a prime equal to eta. Second, look at the second derivatives here. We have this free matrix, completely arbitrary matrix here. Can I use it to set this expression to zero? Well, let's first figure out how many numbers I have to play with. I have d2x alpha by dx prime beta dx prime gamma at the point A. Okay, arbitrary numbers. How many numbers are here? Okay, so there are four indices. So naively, you might say these are 4 times 4 times 4 independent quantities. Is that true? That would be 64 numbers. Symmetric. It's symmetric, okay? So what? How many numbers in a symmetric matrix? 4 by 4. 4 diagonal, right? And how many off diagonal? 6, right? So that means there are 10 numbers in a symmetric. This is 4 times 4. These really are 4 independent numbers with the upper index. Down here, it's symmetric on beta and gamma. So at 4 times 10 numbers. Okay, this is because this is the components, independent components of 4 times 4 symmetric matrix. So you've got 40 numbers to play with, and they're completely arbitrary. You've got 40 numbers to, play with to adjust these coefficients, right? To adjust, and what are those coefficients? Well, those coefficients are simply the first derivatives of the metric in the new coordinate system. So the derivatives of metric. So when I write comma beta, I'm really meaning d by dx beta. G mu nu prime. And this is going to be at the point A prime. Okay. How many numbers here? How many numbers have I got? How many first derivatives? So look at all these coefficients. This is going to be a matrix with indices mu nu, and what it represents is the first derivative of the metric G prime with respect to those coordinates. I can't reach. That should have an index alpha. Okay. So you want to see if you can set all these first derivatives to zero. How many things do you want to set zero? How many quantities are there here? 40, right? Because this is also 4 by 4 symmetric. This is 4. So 40 quantities. Okay, so if I set this coefficient to zero, I'll have 40 linear equations for 40 numbers. Right, just right. So I can set them all to zero. So we can set g alpha beta comma gamma prime equal to zero. Okay, so that's a bit weird. I can choose coordinates, so the metric is eta, first derivative 0. Maybe we've no such thing as interesting geometry. But what Riemann discovered is if you go to next order, then it's much more interesting. Because next order, you can't set them all 0. So next order, let's imagine going to next order, and it's not really going to be that different. I'm going to try and get the right one. All right, what's going to happen at next order? Next order, I'm going to get some stuff which will involve d3x, right? Dx prime, dx prime, dx prime. And then I'm going to get some other things. And this one is free. Everything else I've already determined. I've already determined the first derivatives from setting this equal to 1, the second derivatives from this equals 0. So what I've got is all of these functions to play, these numbers to play with. And these are the coefficients of x prime minus a prime, x prime minus a prime. Okay? So how many numbers have I got, and how many things do I want to try and set, do I want to set 0? So next order, so 3, can I choose dx, dx prime, dx prime, dx prime. Okay, that's what I've got available at the point A, so that the second derivative do I have enough freedom? And this was Riemann's big discovery. How many quantities do I have here? Okay, so this is obviously symmetric under alpha, beta, gamma, right? Because partial derivatives commute. This is a free index. So if I've got an object, a three-component symmetric tensor with four, with indices running from over four values, how many independent quantities do I have? Well, let's do it. So symmetric three-index tensor. Okay. Well, the three indices can be the same. Can be the same. And this would have four different components where they're all the same, right? Or I could have two of them the same. The same. How many ways of doing that? So let's imagine this is 0, 0, 1, right? Two indices the same, one different. How many in total? I've got four possible indices. I'm the jet-lagged one. What's your excuse? Okay, so we've got some tensor, right? Let's do it 1, 2, 3, 4 to make it easy. Okay, so they can all be the same, and there are four of those, right? 1s, 2s, 3s, 4. Or I can have one, two the same, one different. Okay, can pick that in four ways. Pick this in three ways, 12. Okay, or one index, or no indices, the same. It's symmetric, and How many arrangements? Well, it's the one you leave out, okay? There are four, so one, two, three, but you left four out, right? So leave four out, and then there's only one. So, or leave three out, or leave two out, leave one out. So there are four. Okay, so the total number of components is 20. In fact, there's a slick way to do this calculation. You don't need to remember, you know, somebody invented something called Young Tableau. You ever heard about those? Young Tableau? So I advise you to look those up if you ever worried about counting. Young Tableau do it for you straight away. The rule for symmetric tensors is you draw these little boxes. There are three of them, three horizontal boxes, and you label them increasing in this direction, 4, 5, 6. And then what you do is you calculate 4 times 5 times 6, and so you take the product of the boxes, and then you construct what's called hooks, okay? And the hooks do this. They come in from the right, this. What do they do? Am I even remembering it right? Yeah, the number of boxes on the hooks. Okay, so 1, 2, 3. So 1, 2, 3. And hopefully that works. That's 20. So the general rule with Young Tableau is you draw a number of boxes equal to the number of indices. Okay? And then symmetric indices are horizontal. Antisymmetric are vertical. And you multiply, and the vertical numbers go down, so this would be 4, 3. So let's do an antisymmetric. That would be our epsilon tensor. Okay, antisymmetric on all four indices. So I do 4, 3, 2, 1. Draw my hooks. 4, 3, 2. And so there's only one component. Okay, so Young Tableau, very useful for doing this counting. But anyway, we've counted the number of independent quantities we have to play with. And how many quantities do we have here? Well, symmetric under these two, right? So there's 10. Symmetric under those two. These are partial derivatives. So how many here? How many independent quantities have I got here? 10 of those and 10 of those. 100. Of course, I forgot one thing. This was the arrangement for the lower indices, 20, right? But I had times 4, because this can be 4 values. So times 4 equals 80. This is the new index. You don't have enough, okay? So you can set 80 of the second derivatives of the metric to 0, but leaving 20 non-zero. And these are the components of the Riemann tensor. Okay, so that was Riemann's great insight, is that if I've got some general metric, I can always choose coordinates so that locally it's flat, the first derivative is 0, but the second derivative, I can't get rid of 20 components. And in fact, those 20 components tell you everything about the curvature of the space. And I'll leave it to you as a little exercise. Compute in D dimensions. Okay, I did it in 4. Try and do it in 1, 2, 3, etc. Just to make sure you've understood. So I've just been playing around with this metric. Haven't really done anything with it. Just told you that the metric can be used to measure distances. It can also be used to measure volumes. Distances and volumes. And this is very important because in the action for physics, when I wrote down the action, that's an integral over all space-time. That involves the volume of space-time. And you need the metric to measure the volume. So the way we do this is that the metric transforms the distances we've already seen are invariant. And in fact, we define the metric. The transformation rule of the metric was defined in order to make distances invariant. Okay, so that the dx, dx, g was equal to the dx prime, g prime. Okay, so distances are automatically invariant under changes of coordinates. What about volumes? Well, the metric transforms like this. Okay, and so we notice from this that the determinant of the metric, the determinant of g mu nu, which we'll call g. So g without indices is just going to be the determinant of this 4x4 matrix. And so det g prime, now the determinant of a product of matrices, this is just a product, because I've summed over these indices. The determinant of this matrix is just the product of the determinants. Okay, that's a general statement, that the determinant of a product of matrices is the product of the determinants. So this is equal to the determinant dx dx prime squared times g. So the determinant of the metric transforms with two powers of this Jacobian matrix. And so square root of minus the determinant, you see this determinant, the g has one negative and three positive eigenvalues. So its determinant is definitely a negative number. So you need to take a minus sign before you can take the square root. So you're taking the square root of a positive number. And root minus g prime will give you dx dx prime root minus g. Now, you know from integration theory that d for x prime, when I integrate over x prime, this is equal to the Jacobian matrix determinant times d4x. Okay, and what you notice is that this root g transforms with a factor which is exactly the opposite of the Jacobian matrix. And so it follows that d4x prime root minus g prime equals d4x root minus g. Okay, so this is called the invariant volume element. So this is something which is completely independent of coordinates. Another quantity we will often need is the inverse metric. So the metric we defined with downstairs indices, the inverse metric has upstairs indices. G mu nu, it's defined to be the inverse of the one with downstairs indices. So G mu nu, G nu alpha is delta mu alpha. G inverse G is 1. And this transforms in the opposite way to G. G prime mu nu is dx prime. Dx prime nu, dx alpha, dx beta, g alpha beta. So it transforms dx prime dx, whereas g transforms by dx dx prime. And we will use this, so we will use G lowered and G uppered to raise and lower indices, just as in special relativity. Okay, so let's do some examples of metrics to convince you this is a useful concept. I'll leave that. Examples. So as a kind of trivial example, let's consider a two-dimensional sphere embedded in three-dimensional Euclidean space. And this is what the ancient Greeks would have done. And so they would have said the sphere is x squared plus y squared plus z squared equals 1. And so to solve, so the sphere obviously sits inside Euclidean space, and it's this two-dimensional surface. Satisfying that equation, the solution of that equation is that x is sine theta cos phi, y is sine theta sine phi, z is cos theta. So that obviously satisfies this equation, and there are two free parameters, theta and phi, and this describes the embedding coordinate. These are the embedding coordinates. And theta and phi are the intrinsic coordinates. Okay, so every point on the sphere is given by one value of theta and phi, so that's why it is a two-dimensional space. The metric, so what is the metric on the sphere? Well, it's just the distances. Just think of the distances between any two points on the sphere. And the metric, the simplest metric to put on a sphere, is just the one which you inherit from the embedding space, which is flat. And the metric in the embedding space is just Pythagoras' metric, dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. And so all of Riemannian geometry is described by saying just use the Pythagorean metric locally. again, on small scales. And the notion is very intuitive. When I look at the sphere around some point, basically looks like flat space. Okay, it's a little bit bent, but if I zoom in close enough to any point, this space just looks like flat space, and I should be able to use Pythagoras's metric. So the metric on the sphere is inherited from E3. And the metric on E3 is just dx squared plus dy squared plus dz squared. So what I'm supposed to do is use the Euclidean metric, or Pythagorean metric, okay, but constrained to the sphere. And so if you just substitute those formulae in, you'll find d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. And this is the metric on the two-sphere. Does it look flat? Well, remember what these coordinates are. Let me just draw it a little bit bigger. Here is theta. Okay, so z is cosine of theta, and this is sine theta. So phi runs around this direction. This would be phi. And obviously, if I look in these coordinates at a point on the equator, right, so this is where theta equals pi over 2, then this is equal to d theta squared plus d phi squared when theta is approximately pi over 2. So let's do an approximate here. So in other words, if I center my coordinates on this point, then the usual spherical polar coordinates are nothing but flat space coordinates around a point, any point on the equator. But they're very far from flat coordinates at the North Pole. Yeah.
Two questions. When you said that this is the easiest metric to put on the sphere because it's the one that you inherit from
E3.
Euclidean space, right? But so there's the possibility to put another metric in.
Absolutely.
And how do you know? I mean,
you can put any metric on any space.
And it does, I mean,
modulo dimension and so on, yes.
Okay, but the metric has to respect something that tells me that I'm on a sphere?
The metric defines what you're on. So there are two separate notions. There's a topological space, which means a set of points with some relationships. And the relationships just say, who are my neighbors? Okay, that's a topological space. It has, there's no notion of metric on such a space. And so you could imagine a rubber sheet, which is a topological space, and you stretch it around and nothing changes, actually, from the topological point of view. But from the geometrical point of view, you can't really do geometry without a metric. You need something to define angles and distances. And this metric does that. Now, but you have huge freedom as to what metric you put. And so one way of picturing is to say, well, I have this rubber sheet, but actually I'm going to go around the rubber sheet with a flat plane, and I'm going to look tangentially to the rubber sheet, what's the geometry on the sheet. And the flat plane is actually, so I insist that this curve geometry is locally flat, and then I assign this metric, and the metric tells me the correspondence between this topological space and a locally flat space. That's what the metric does. So you should think about the geometry as actually being associated with the metric. Once you've picked the metric, it defines the geometry.
And the other thing is that whether you call a curved space, because the sphere here clearly has curvature.
Yes.
I always think in terms of the Gaussian curvature.
Yes.
Right? But
yes.
Is it the same as what you're meaning here?
Okay. No. No, the curvature Riemann used was the intrinsic curvature. Gaussian curvature is an extrinsic notion. So I think about embedding this in some space, and then I can sort of look at the curvature of the surface as it lies in the embedding space. The Riemannian curvature is something different. The Riemannian curvature says, no, let's, in general, forget about this embedding space. Riemann says, no, just concentrate on the surface itself. Forget about how, in many cases, it's not embedded in anything. It just exists. And it comes with a metric. And let's see what are the properties intrinsic to the surface, which we can describe with a metric. And the curvature comes from the fact that you cannot set the metric equal to flat beyond first order and derivatives. Locally, at one point, I can set it flat, as at this point. I can set the first derivative to zero. So if you Taylor expand sine theta around theta equals pi over 2, it has a maximum there, right? So the first derivative vanishes, but the second derivative is not zero. So I'm going to get this plus corrections, theta minus pi over 2 squared, okay, times d phi squared. And this I cannot set zero using a coordinate transformation. There are no coordinates in which I can set that zero. And this is because the surface is curved. So the metric encodes that curvature.
So in terms of your Riemann tensor,
yes.
Say you have 20 non-zero.
Yes,
right,
in 4D.
Okay.
In 2D, it right. Turns out there's only one. In 2D, if you repeat this exercise in two dimensions, so this two-sphere is two-dimensional, when you repeat the exercise, you will find there's only one component of Riemann. Okay, there is one second derivative of the metric which you cannot set zero by a coordinate transformation. And that's the Riemann tensor. We're going to build the Riemann tensor, so you'll see much more detail. Now that's one coordinate system on a sphere. Okay, by the way, all of vector calculus and so on, which you did as undergrads, all of that will emerge from this in a very, very simple way. So that's the plus. You're learning some machinery, but what you're going to learn is that everything you learned before wasn't useful or can be replaced by a much more powerful machinery. And one of the things you see, so once I have this metric, well, the metric is this guy. It's a two-dimensional matrix, 2x2 matrix, with 1 in the theta-theta direction, and sine squared theta in the phi-phi direction, and 0 in the off-diagonal. So that's the metric on a two-sphere. And the volume element, okay, I told you, is root minus g. In this case, we're doing a Riemannian manifold. There's no minus one. I didn't put any time on the sphere. So the volume element here is just root g d2x. And the determinant of the metric is sine theta, is sine squared theta. Square root gives me sine theta. So now I get d theta d phi. And that's exactly the volume you use in vector calculus. Yeah.
So you said that the Riemannian curvature is something that's independent of the embedding.
Right.
But so what then would be the problem if I just decided I wanted a metric on this, which was d theta plus d phi? Because so obviously at the poles, you'd have some divergence in.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so. It would, okay, so what's wrong? If I just say I'm going to pick this metric, it's a good question. So think carefully about, you see, we took the sphere and we defined these coordinates. And notice that these coordinates, the way we defined it from the embedding, these coordinates, theta goes from naught to pi, right? Theta equals zero is the north pole. Theta equals pi is the south pole. And then phi goes from 0 to 2 pi. But the point 2 pi is identified with the point 0, because phi is this periodic coordinate. Theta is not periodic. And then you, let's see. And now the problem, if I put a metric like this on the sphere, well, you tell me. You see, so let's draw our space, theta and phi. So phi goes from 0 to 2 pi, theta goes from 0 to pi. Okay, so we, the basic notion of Riemannian geometry is that every point should look locally like flat space. Okay. Now, in these coordinates, when theta is zero, it's really only one point. Okay, so all of this here is really just one point. Okay, so in other words, phi, we say phi is a singular coordinate at the North Pole because it's many valued. One point on the manifold, the North Pole, corresponds to many values of phi. So phi is a singular coordinate, but you've made your metric that doesn't look singular at that point. And so the North Pole in this metric is not like flat space. So this must be wrong. Whereas if I worked with this metric, I would say, no, the metric is this one, okay, near the North Pole. So theta is nearly zero. So this becomes theta squared d phi squared. And I say, ooh, so what does the space look like near theta equals zero? Well, it looks like that. Now, that still looks singular. I mean, obviously, the metric is even degenerate. It's not even invertible at theta equals zero, right? Theta equals zero, the metric wouldn't be invertible. But I say, never mind, because these coordinates were singular, right? Many points were one point was represented by many coordinates. So I have to change coordinates. And then you notice, what is this? Well, this is just flat space in spherical coordinates. So this we know is just dx squared plus dy squared in coordinates where x is theta sine phi and y cosine phi and y is theta sine phi. So given this metric, I know I can change coordinates to ones in which it is locally flat space. Okay? So you must never take any one coordinate system seriously, okay? Unless everything is completely regular, it's really one-to-one, and then you can take it seriously. But most coordinate systems, most coordinate systems have points which are badly described. And then you must keep in mind that you're always free to change coordinates, but the definition of a Riemannian geometry is one where locally, I can always choose coordinates such that it's flat space. Yeah.
Respect to that, so if I take my sphere not embedded in the Pleiadian space and I
right.
put a metric, that metric must be equivalent to the one that inherits from the Pleiadian space, or not necessarily?
No. So there are two separate notions, the topological space and the metric space. And you might decide to take this topological space from the embedding and put another metric on it. You're free to do that.
I have two different manifolds, and I can put the same metric to them, right? Or I cannot differentiate between one and the other locally or something.
When you have a metric, you can. Okay. So topological space plus metric is a geometry.
Okay.
Once you've assigned a metric, then it's different than some other space where you assigned a different metric. So there are, in general, many choices of metrics on the same space, and together once you have the metric and the notion of the of which space you're talking about, you know that defines the Riemannian geometry. Okay, so I think I've run out of time. I just want to tell you one more thing. Another coordinate system on the two sphere. Just to give you this, David may have done this. Did you do stereographic coordinates? No. Okay.
In complex analysis, yeah.
Oh, in complex analysis. Okay, good. So this should be somewhat familiar. You see, this spherical polars on a two-sphere are obviously bad at two points. They're bad here and they're bad there, right? Because this is one point, but it's specified by all phis and theta equals zero. This is also one point, but theta is pi, but it's specified by all phis. So we say that, in fact, on a sphere, it's impossible to choose a coordinate system which is non-singular everywhere. But you can do better than spherical polars. You can use stereographic coordinates. And again, we think about embedding this sphere in E3. And we draw a picture like this. We draw our sphere like this. Now let me just remember. Yeah, so the origin is here. This is E3. So every point has a x, y, z. The origin is here. And then stereographic coordinates are the following. That I pick some point on the sphere, okay, and then I consider a straight line from the south pole through that point and see where it intersects the plane. So I choose a plane going through the north pole and project every point onto that plane from the south pole. So can you just immediately see which point is singular in stereographic coordinates? South pole, right? Because basically, as I try to describe points around here, they're going to be projected further and further out on the plane. And when I reach to the south pole, that's actually the point at infinity on the plane. It's not the point, it's actually the whole of infinity, right? Because I could have approached the south pole from any possible direction. So the circle at infinity on this plane is actually one point on the sphere. So if you work this out, this let's call this z1. These are I'm going to call them x1, x2, x3. This plane is going to have coordinates z1, z2. It's a two-dimensional flat surface. This point, let me just try and draw this a little better. This distance here is x3. So that distance is 1 plus x3. It's a unit sphere, so the radius is 1. And now draw similar triangles. So this is 1 plus x3. This distance is it's x1. And so you can see that this triangle is, of course, similar to that triangle. And so we can see from this that z1 over 2, the diameter of the sphere is 2. So this over 2 is equal to x1 over 1 plus x3. And similarly, z2 over 2 is equal to x2 over 1 plus x3. And then I'll leave it to you as an exercise, dx1 squared plus dx2 squared. Again, the embedding metric is equal to 4, dz1 squared plus dz2 squared over 1 plus z1 squared plus z2 squared, all squared, which is equal to. So on this plane, I can choose coordinates so that z1 is radius cos theta, z2 is radius sine theta. And then the metric becomes 4 times the metric on flat two-dimensional space. That's coming from the numerator, divided by 1 plus radius squared squared. So in these coordinates, the metric on the sphere is the flat two-dimensional metric. You see, so in fact, this is your d theta squared plus d phi squared metric, okay? But with this factor, which we call a conformal factor. So yeah, I've gone on too long. I'm sorry. any questions? I think maybe they need a 5-minute break.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. All right.